What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
The others around the table would be actor friends. Dim figures you may still remember from the silent days. I used to think of them as her waxworks.
One diamond. One heart.
Spade?
Pass.
I promise that's the last time you'll hear that voice on the show.
The one and only Buster Keaton there, passing in 1950s Sunset Boulevard. This week, we go back to Keaton's glory days as a star of silent cinema. It's the start of our Buster Keaton marathon. We'll discuss four classic Keaton shorts, plus the return of Film Spotting Madness. That and more.
Pass.
Ahead on Film Spotting. Welcome back to Film Spotting. You can't pass, Josh. You're forced to participate. Film Spotting Madness is back, baby.
Yes, it is. Next 3 months. Can't wait.
It's our eighth annual bracket style movie elimination tournament pop quiz. I know you're going to be so prepared for this, and our memories are so intact at this point. What was the theme of last year's tournament? I think you'll be able to get that one. And which film won it all?
Oh, wow. Yeah, testing my investment right here off the top. Huh? Okay. I know it was Best of the 80s. I do know that.
Yeah.
I mean, was it Raging Bull?
It was not Raging Bull. Raging Bull didn't even make the top three.
Oh, boy. Just give it to
me. How about Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, taking out Raiders of the Lost Ark, which ended up finishing third. A bit of a surprise, Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, the runner-up of Film Spotting Madness 2021, which was the best of the 80s.
That was good times. Thanks for reminding me of that. I was really happy when Do the Right Thing won, and then pretty much immediately forgot it.
Yeah, well, I think you will enjoy Film Spotting Madness 2022, the best of the 1970s, as we really get into it. You'll get some momentum going as we really get into the tournament proper next week on the show. I will confess, thoroughly invested in Film Spotting Madness, as you know, Josh, and I couldn't remember which film won it last year. I did have to look it up.
All right. Well, I feel a little better then.
64 classic films. They enter the arena. Only one of them survives. We will kick off the tourney with our play-in round this week. 21 matchups that will determine that final bracket. Later in the show, we will talk through those matchups and make our picks. I am betting on this being a patented Josh Larson, I'm reacting in real time segments.
That's the plan. I did no prep. I don't know what these matchups are. I'm very curious to see them. And yeah, you're just going to get my instant response to which way I should vote.
Love it. Madness is kicking off, and so is our latest Film Spotting Marathon, our deep dive. Usually we do two of them a year into the work of a particular director or performer or genre or regional cinema. This time, our subject is silent film star Buster Keaton. Keaton, of course, one of the big three silent era comedians, along with Chaplin and Harold Lloyd. And like Chaplin, Keaton was not only the star of his best-known films, but also the writer and the director, or occasionally listed as a co-director. These marathons are typically a chance for us to knock out some blind spots. In a perfect world, whether it's four, five, or six movies, neither of us have seen any of them. That doesn't usually play out that way. There's one or two that one or both of us have seen, but what's your history here quickly with Keaton, Josh?
Yeah, Keaton's a great marathon subject for that reason. I've seen some of his stuff. By no means am I a completist, and I'm really excited about the opportunity to fill in some of those holes. I've seen a couple of shorts, none of the four we're going to talk about tonight, so that was great to get to see those for the first time. As far as the features, I do know it's one of those instances, Adam, a few of these I'm going to have to watch to remember if I actually sat down and have seen the whole thing rather than just the famous clips. But I do know that Steamboat Bill Jr. and Sherlock Jr., I have seen both of those. Actually wrote about them in my book, In Movies Are Prayers, the whole chapter on movies as prayers of contemplation and meditation. I chose to kind of focus on Keaton, open that chapter with Steamboat Bill Jr. as Keaton being this figure of serenity in the midst of chaos. We'll probably touch on that as we get into the marathon. So yeah, know those two films pretty well, but otherwise really excited to see some of this stuff for the first time.
Serenity in the midst of chaos. Did you touch on the fact that he's usually the one causing the chaos?
Yeah, but I think that's what's interesting is that is the case in some of these shorts we're going to talk about for sure. But in a lot of his films, it's chaos thrust upon him. These forces, you know, weather so often, right? This we're going to talk about it in 1 week, right? How weather comes down to bear on him. So a lot of times it can go the other way, too. He kind of plays both sides of that coin, which is why he's a fascinating figure.
Even cops to some extent.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, he just ends up in the wrong parade.
Yep. That's a perfect example.
So I know I've seen at least two of these four shorts before because I was able to dig up some papers I wrote for a class on silent comedy, specifically about Chaplin and Keaton. It was an entire semester film authors class back at the University of Iowa. And when I did my quick search in my Google Docs, no, I did not write them in Google Docs.
I was going to say.
I wasn't in school that recently, unfortunately, as I'll clarify here in a moment. But I did find those files that were on, you know, something we used to call a floppy disk, Josh. And I transferred them at some point, and I did a quick search, and I talked about 1 week, and I talked about the Playhouse. I'm pretty sure I saw Cops as well as part of that class, and all of those features. So this is a marathon where I'm really familiar with the subject, but at the same time, that class was 24 years ago. And if it wasn't for those searches, I would not be able to verify that I had seen these films before. It really does feel like a lifetime ago. So I will be rediscovering these films as part of this marathon. The impetus for us to take on this Keaton marathon now is the new book from friend of the show and film critic over at Slate, Dana Stevens. Her book is called Cameraman, Buster Keaton, The Dawn of Cinema and the Invention of the 20th Century. It's not just a Keaton biography. It's a critical study of the era and Keaton's place in it. Dana was also so generous as to curate this marathon for us. So these titles handpicked by our very own Buster Keaton expert.
More than that, she said she's going to come on the show when we reach the end of this marathon and do our awards and hopefully tell us how smart we are in our picks. You know, that's what I'm expecting. And maybe she'll throw in a few of her opinions as well.
Yeah, or we'll see just how wrong we got everything.
Totally misunderstood Keaton.
Yeah, might be the case. The marathon will cover Keaton's best-known features, some of the titles you've already heard, like Steamboat Bill Jr., Sherlock Jr., The General. But we are starting by taking a look at a few of his shorts, all four of them made between 1920 and 1923, a very productive period that saw Keaton write, direct, and star in over 20 short films.
In her book, Dana puts these films in the context of a hugely destabilizing time in American and world history. So it's only a couple of years removed from the end of World War I and a global influenza epidemic, which killed tens of millions worldwide and hundreds of thousands in the U.S. The passage in 1918 and 1919 of the 18th and 19th Amendments, the first of those amendments initiated the Prohibition era. The second gave women the right to vote. Dana also puts Keaton in the company of other lost generation artists who helped to define the era. So she discusses F. Scott Fitzgerald, Dorothy Parker, Hemingway, Bessie Smith, and Martha Graham, and touches also on international artists like Louis Buñuel and Bertolt Brecht. Dana makes the case that, like these artists, Keaton made work that reflects an era of pervasive anxiety and a desire to remake and reinvent a broken world from the ground up. Invention, Adam, probably a good place to start with Keaton. After starting on the vaudeville circuit as a child performer with his family and following a 3-year apprenticeship with the early silent movie star Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle, Keaton started to make his own films. The four shorts we watched for this week, again, this is just a small percentage of the films he made in his first 3 years as an independent artist. They contain an astounding degree of comic invention, stunts, camera trickery, set design, action. Honestly, it was almost like, how are you wasting these ideas? This is how it seems to me from a 2022 mindset. How are you wasting these ideas on a short? You know, obviously shorts were the thing then, but that's how it felt watching some of these.
A quick run through of the four titles, and then we'll jump into our responses to them. 1 week from 1920, and I'll note here that all four of these shorts are what are called two reelers, so about 20 minutes total, 10 minutes per reel It was the typical length of silent comedies of the era. In this one, Keaton and Sybil Seeley are newlyweds whose effort to start a life together is sabotaged by her ex-beau. The theme of marriage, or the plot point of marriage, runs through all of these shorts. I think this is the only one, though, where they actually start married,
right,
as opposed to him seeking a woman's hand in marriage. The Scarecrow from 1920 has Buster competing for the attention of a farmer's daughter. He shares a one-room house with Joe Roberts, who appears in multiple of these shorts. He gets chased by a dog, and yes, he does pretend to be a scarecrow. There's The Playhouse from 1921, where Keaton has, let's say, a very Malkovich dream, and then does wreak havoc. Finally, Cops from 1922, where Keaton is mistaken for a terrorist bomber. I'm not going to ask you to rank the movies in terms of how much you enjoyed them, but I am curious, Josh, whether you had a clear favorite among the bunch, and maybe if you had a clear least favorite, and if somewhere in the distinction between the two, we find what appeals to you most about Keaton.
I did have a clear favorite, and it was 1 week, and I liked all of these, to, you know, be perfectly clear about it. But I think it goes back to what I was just saying about the ambition and the level of stunts that are in these films. For me, 1 week had the largest ones, whether it's the home itself that they build. So the conceit is essentially these newlyweds get a gift from this uncle where it's a build your own home kit, and they get a lot, a property, and they spend this week putting this, you know, like mega IKEA concept together. And so you have this massive set that during a storm spins around, has so many moving pieces itself. And then you also have, we're going to be spoiling these. I mean, these are 100-year-old films, so I think it's okay to spoil these. But you have that climactic moment with the train, where they've decided to move this house to a different lot, and they go over these railroad tracks. First, they think it's going to get hit. Great gag. It's the train on the other line, so it passes by. And then while they're not watching, a train comes by on the line that it is on and smashes it. I mean, just the scale of these set pieces is astounding to me. And some of these other shorts have impressively scaled set pieces as well. But for me, 1 week had the biggest and the best of those. And it also had a strong emotional through line for me in the relationship of this married couple. Mm. And it had, you know, some smart satire, I think, about not only how marriage was envisioned at the time, but how I think it's still considered to be in American society today, is just this easy thing that once you achieve, you've just figured it all out and it's happily ever after, right? And the very concept, the very structure of this film sends that up. Marriage is not something you buy in a box and put together according to the instructions and you're good to go. It's a little more difficult than that. And it's also very romantic. It starts really sour. Sour, I think, is a word that is used at one point to describe romance in a very early intertitle. And you have that sign on the back of the couple's car as they leave the church. Good luck. You'll need it. But what happens at the end? After their house is dashed to smithereens, this couple, Sybil Seeley again with Keaton, who have been very persistent and committed throughout all the mishaps that have happened, they just kind of clasp hands and walk along down the track together. They're gonna keep working at it, even though their house has been smashed to smithereens. So that's a lot on 1 week. We can get to some of the others. I can't wait to hear which one was your favorite. But for me, all of that did put it at the very top of these four shorts.
Yeah, 1 week is definitely fantastic. And maybe my second favorite. I actually did have one I liked a little bit more. And it doesn't have the real romantic angle as much as 1 week does. It doesn't really have the satire, unless I'm dramatically overlooking something. And it doesn't have the scale either. But that restriction, or its limited scope, is actually where I think the most inventiveness comes from. And it's The Scarecrow, which is the one of these four I don't think I had ever seen before. The line you mention when we were setting these movies up, and it's a paraphrase, I don't think it's an actual line, but a paraphrase of our producer Sam's, of what Dana argues in her book, this anxiety that artists had during this time period to remake and reinvent a broken world from the ground up. I don't know how conscious that is for Keaton, right? But we see so much construction, to your point. 1 week, obviously, is ground zero for that. There's so much actual construction within a lot of these films. But then there's the inventiveness with everyday objects like homes, things we just sort of take for granted as these purely functional things. He takes things that we experience or interact with or use every day and makes us see them in a completely different way. And so when we start the Scarecrow, and there is a title card that says, all of these rooms are in one room. And it is a case where he is sharing this home, and it's basically a studio home, right? There are no other rooms, except what they've done is managed to find ways to use their space efficiently and economically and change it from bedroom to dining area to living area. And that subversion of kind of our expectations and the character's expectations too, we'll touch on in a variety of ways with the comedy here. But that inventiveness of just that concept was something that I found really remarkable. And the way things pay off then within that concept, after they eat their meal, we see him doing the dishes. And they've basically just taken the top of the table and they put it on the wall and he sprays it down. But then that's not the end of it. They just have all the food that's left fall down a chute and it goes to the animals that are in the yard. And that's kind of clever enough, right? Even thinking about it in those terms that they may have these animals to feed. So why not just, you know, two birds with one stone, clean the table and also feed them. But then as he washes down the table, the water goes down the chute, and now we see the pig in the mud in the water as well. And that's where I think you really see the brilliance of Keaton.
That is such a great sequence. It's early on how they just go through their morning routine. And this is Joe Roberts here as his roommate. And it had to, I mean, there have to be so many ways that Keaton influenced Jacques Tati, but this one in particular, the Scarecrow and this house sequence made me think even more than 1 week, which also revolved around a house, of Ma and Uncle and just the technological innovations in that Tati film. And that's what we have here. All of these ways that, yes, the bathtub will double as a couch. And when that flips over, the water from the bathtub goes out into the yard to create a pond for the ducks to swim in. Mm-hmm. So this stuff is great, including what I can only describe as a breakfast ballet, as the two men are sitting at their table. They have salt shakers and other, you know, things for condiments hanging from strings from the ceiling, and they just swing them back and forth without even looking up at each other, depending on what they need. And it is so brilliantly choreographed and, yeah, just hugely entertaining. So you mentioned anxiety, Adam, and I think that's, you know, so key for me, really more so in another of these shorts, and that was The Playhouse, which is the one which is, I have to think of, you know, considering influences, this had to be an influence on The Muppet Show. I mean, it's set all sorts of backstage hijinks at this theater, this vaudeville theater with these performances. So you have that aspect, but you also have, how about the two grumpy old men in the front row who are commenting on the acts and responding to the acts? So I got a lot of Muppets vibes from this. But in terms of the anxiety, how about the early, this is the dream sequence, actually, where Keaton's character, who does work at this playhouse, is so overwhelmed, you have to think, by his responsibilities that he has dreamt that every role in the house has to be fulfilled by himself, on stage, off stage, in the audience, backstage. So we get dozens of Keatons here, right? Oftentimes in cutaway shots, but often using an in-camera effect, multiple exposure, so rewinding the actual film to get a double, another exposure. So there are two Keatons in the same frame. And I think in one instance, there's four, right? When he plays the pit orchestra. And it was essentially that pit orchestra moment that really highlighted this short as capturing the existential angst of something I think of as very 21st century which is multitasking, and just how your brain starts to fry the more things you try to do at once. As I'm watching Keaton in one frame play the cello, you know, and then blowing on a horn and playing the drums all at once, and things get frantic, increasingly frantic. He can't keep up. He has to use, I think, a saw at one point he's trying to use to play. And for me, that captured that anxiety you're talking about in a very modern way. It's like it's an anxiety dream that he's having, essentially, which also has a lot of laughs in it for us.
So I think the playhouse is laden with anxiety, though I read that dream sequence differently than you.
Aspirational?
I see it as a fantasy. He is a janitor. He wakes up from that sequence where we don't realize that he's on a stage, but of course the men who run it come in and they kick him out and they say, basically, get to work. And it's like he was finally getting to live out the dream of being the star of it all.
Yeah, I can see
and
that.
I did read, I think it was on Wikipedia, they made a note about this, that the fact that he has a co-director on this film, and there are at least two here that he has the same co-director, I think his name's Eddie Klein. But in this case, he had mentioned, Keaton himself, that he only really did that because the line in the playhouse where a Keaton character says something like, well, this Keaton guy sure seems to do it all, was actually a jab at another director from the time who loved to list himself as everything in the credits. And so he listed a co-director just so that it wouldn't look hypocritical, like he was giving himself all the credit for making this film. But yeah, I saw it as more of a fantasy where, oh, he now gets to play out all of these roles. And you're right, that sequence where he's the composer, and then in each part of the pit, I think there's three versions of Keaton on each side doing the playing. And then we get that trick photography of that duet dance with himself that's perfectly in sync and really fun to watch. And I was also thinking while watching this, you were thinking about the Muppets. Probably this will be the last time, maybe it won't, but it could be the last time we mention, I don't know, Coming to America or the Nutty Professor movies. Aren't those the movies that Eddie Murphy remade?
Yeah.
Josh, the Nutty Professor. But this is a precursor to all of that. This is Keaton playing like 20 different roles. Some of them he looks like Buster Keaton, but in other cases he's playing men, he's playing women, he's playing young characters, he's playing old characters. This really is inventive, I think, a little bit more beyond the trick photography. It's more inventive in all the different ways we get to see Keaton play with character.
Yeah, and probably a good point to mention that this is also an instance of Keaton in blackface or employing blackface in one of his shorts. And Dana, in her book, really delves into sort of the tradition of that and how Keaton would have encountered it in his vaudeville days as a kid and other stars, African-American stars of the time who were working on the stage and then eventually in screen. So that's another really great sort of side channel that Dana goes down in her book that I would recommend, why people should pick that up. But yeah, I think, you know, this one is, it's there's so much going on, and that adds to the anxiousness too. Just this activity and the fact that it is all emanating from this one performer. Now, you mentioned Eddie Klein. I think the credits here are Edward F. Klein, actually credited as co-writer and co-director on all four of these shorts, which is really interesting. And, you know, we often think, at least the first time I started thinking of Keaton, I thought of him more just as a star. And it wasn't until I started actually watching some of this stuff and realizing how much of a hand he had in it. But also, at least for the shorts that we're considering today, had a key collaborator in Klein as a co-writer and co-director.
We have talked about all of the shorts so far, except really Cops. And maybe a way to get in to Cops would be for me to ask you if you had a favorite gag throughout these four films, one particular standout moment in terms of the comedy. And Cops has a contender for me, even though it's relatively subtle or it's relatively common in terms of this type of gag we see in Keaton's work, we see in these four films. It's really the start of Cops, where he is interacting with a rich man. And I don't remember the exact sequence, but I think it's a series of three kind of little tricks that happen with this guy, where he fools him and kind of ends up with his wallet. And then he ends up giving the wallet back, but he's got his cash. And then the guy wants his cash back and he gets in a cab. But the next thing you know, Buster's the one who's actually gotten in the cab and taken his seat. In all three instances, he has managed to kind of get the upper hand on the guy. And that repetition of the gag, the constant surprise of it, just when you think you've gotten the joke, and then Buster adds a second part, and then he adds a third part on top of it. That was one of the standout ones for me.
Yeah, it's really good and ties into really the first third of Cops, which is mostly about the way money and possessions can be easy come, easy go. Because after that sequence, Buster gets tricked, right? A guy tricks him into giving that money away to buy this furniture, which doesn't even belong to that guy. It belongs to this family who's moving and has put it out on the sidewalk. So yeah, it's this kind of rotating gag where he is the instigator in some ways, but then becomes the victim just a few seconds later. Maybe my favorite gag would probably go back to 1 week, and it is the train smashing the house at the very end. I mean, again, it goes just back to the Brevera scale of it. But there is a great one in Cops, and it is, in addition to the one you mentioned, where at this point he has haphazardly, unwittingly tossed that bomb after lighting his cigarette, right? He uses the fuse to light his cigarette, doesn't realize what it is, just tosses it, and it explodes in the midst of this policeman parade. So the rest of the short, like 60, 100 policemen are chasing him. And at one point, he goes up a ladder that's against a wall that ends. It's like, the wall ends about maybe 12 feet up. And so the ladder starts to tip and you get a teeter-totter gag. So he's trying to balance it. Cops find him, grab the ladder at one end, pull it down. Cops on the other end of the wall can't see the others, so they grab the other end, and it's kind of this ongoing teeter-totter thing, which I think is just fantastic. But did Cops strike you as kind of dark? I mean, maybe it's obvious we're talking about bombs being thrown at police, and it's all played for a comic effect. But wow, the more and more Keaton circled around this city being chased by an increasing number of uniformed policemen. Maybe I'm just looking at this through political 2022 eyes, but I wonder if there's a little commentary here about the overzealousness of law enforcement and how, yes, there's a guy who, as far as they know, is like a prime suspect that needs to be captured. But just the fact that we're getting, 100 policemen increasingly irate chasing after him did make me kind of see it that way. And it kind of ends on a dark note, too, in terms of what actually happens to our hero who, in the other features makes it out okay, pretty much okay by the end. Not so much here.
Yeah, I think that sense of exploring the exploited and thumbing his nose at authority is something we see from Keaton in some of these films and we'll probably see more of throughout this marathon. I go back to 1 week and the Scarecrow for my other favorite gag candidates. We've already seen at one point where Buster has walked through a room and opened a door that, if this place was constructed properly, should take him into another room. And of course, it just takes him head over heels into the grass. He falls basically down because there's nothing there to catch him. And so we've seen that, which means we know that when that door gets opened again by another character, that they're going to go right out onto the grass, just like Buster does. And I think that there's something to that as well, that math being done by the audience when we know something's coming because it's been set up before. Even in Cops, it's really close together, but you mentioned the bomb. The way that's handled, where I think the order is, we see someone on a rooftop holding a bomb like they're about to throw it, and we see Buster in the front of his carriage trying to light a cigarette and have nothing to light it with.
Yeah.
And so you know before Buster does that what's going to happen next is that bomb's going to land there and he's going to use it to light his cigarette. So I like that moment in 1 week. And I also really like the moment where at the end, he's trying to drag the car. He's trying to drag the house with his car across the lot to where he should park his house. And the rope breaks. So he tries to nail it.
Yes.
He nails his car seat to the house, and he's going to drive and pull it like he's towing it. And of course, we don't think this is going to work, But what we don't expect is exactly what happens, which is the top part of the car stays attached right. and the bottom rolls away. And it's actually a repeat in a way of a gag earlier in the film, right? Day one of building the house where he's doing some sawing of a board
yeah.
on top. And he puts the nail in and then he tries to cut a piece. And actually in that instance, he successfully cuts it, but goes down with the board.
Can I just say one of the reasons I love 1 week so much, I think, is because my handyman skills are very similar to Buster Keaton's.
Oh, yeah.
I just assume like, I mean, a nail, you just nail something in and that solves everything, right? and no, not quite everything is a disaster. I would never have been able to put that house together either.
Yeah, who knows? He may read directions better than I do. We'll never know because the boxes got switched on him, right?
That's true.
The other one I was going to mention was just from The Scarecrow, where he runs around the top of the ruined house.
Oh, but how about the
with
dog?
With the dog chasing him. Every part of that is just insanely brilliant.
Luke, the dog.
The dog changing direction and going after him, and you see the big gaps and you think, well, they'll never be able to cross those. And of course, they glide right over them. That was so inspired. And what about that moment with the Scarecrow as well, where he acts like the Scarecrow? He's being chased
it's
by
really
two
good.
Men, and he puts on the clothes and he poses just like a Scarecrow and fools them for a little bit anyway. That kind of physicality, even though I suppose it's a little ironic that he's actually being still in that moment, but he's so perfectly replicating how a Scarecrow looks that it is believable. And it's no different than in some of these other films that we watched where he's acting like a horse. He's acting like an orangutan. He is acting in a very machine-like way. A lot of times that's where Keaton's physicality really comes through.
So I want to give a word of encouragement to anyone who's listening and has not yet committed to watching some of these or wants to play along with the marathon. I don't know why you'd be listening now. Maybe it's only those people who have already bought in. But really, I have found these to be incredibly stress relieving. And maybe it has something to do with them just being 20 minutes long. But, you know, finding I've got a half hour, so I'm going to sit down and watch one of these. My mood at the end of that 20 minutes is entirely different. And I find what I'm doing. Actually, Debbie pointed this out because when I watched the first one, we were away for a weekend trip and I managed to sit down, just watch one while we had some time to kill. And I was on my iPad. She goes, "What are you doing over there?" Because I didn't realize I had been basically chuckling for good 12 to 15 minutes. Right.
Yeah.
And I wasn't laughing out loud. I wasn't really gasping. I think both of those would be completely reasonable responses mm-hmm. to some of these shorts. But I had just spent 15 to 20 minutes kind of like quietly chuckling to myself. And I don't think I do that enough in my life. So if you feel like you could use that, if you could use, you know, a few chuckles just in the middle of your day, at least check out some of these shorts and hopefully that'll hook you and you'll want to join us for the rest of the marathon.
So you're saying that watching Buster deal with his anxiety on screen
yeah.
relieved your anxiety.
Basically, I know, despite okay. what we said about anxiety being a common theme, I think that's true. And yeah, I think it is a little cathartic.
The Buster Keaton Marathon continues next week with Keaton's first feature-length comedy, 1923's Our Hospitality. More information about the marathon, including links to watch these films that we just discussed online, is available at filmspotting.net/marathons.
Are you ready for the madness?
Oh, you know I am.
Film Spotting Madness. I think I am. Our annual bracket-style movie elimination tournament kicks off next with the play-in round, plus results for the latest Film Spotting poll, asking you which of the acting Batmen, you know, Keaton, Kilmer, Clooney, and the rest, has the strongest filmography. Stay with us.
the sky. It's not just a call. It's a warning.
Well, consider us warned. You're listening to Film Spotting. Robert Pattinson there as The Batman, which comes to theaters next weekend. We like Robert Pattinson here on the show. Director Matt Reeves has made some good things. I saw at least one of the Planet of the Apes movies that he did. For some reason, I never did see Let Me In, the 2010 remake of Let the Right One In, the Swedish vampire movie, which I absolutely adored. That's neither here nor there. There are reasons to be interested in The Batman, regardless of how much you care about so-called comic book movies. And yet I am curious, Josh, what is your appetite for another Batman movie at this time?
I mean, I've long been fascinated by the character of Batman, but I think I have enough movies to fill that fascination for a lifetime. But if you told me there's a Robert Pattinson starring film directed by Matt Reeves and didn't tell me anything else, I would be all in. So yeah, intrigued.
Okay. Next week, we'll review The Batman and we will continue our Buster Keaton marathon. Also next week, it's the official start, round one of Film Spotting Madness, Best of the 70s. We've got some Madness play-in matchups to discuss here in just a bit, but first, some deeply flawed Film Spotting poll results. Last week, as we were looking ahead to the new Batman and the new actor playing Batman, we asked you, if you can only keep one Batman actor's entire filmography, which one is it? Again, to clarify, you get to keep all the films that a single actor who played Batman appeared in. The other films that the other actors who played Batman were in, they are gone forever into the film spotting incinerator, never to be seen again. The actors themselves, I guess Sam is making this clear, they get to continue living happy, productive lives.
Yeah, I mean, we're not monsters here. Now, let me back up and ask, why is this a deeply flawed film spotting poll results report? Are we not happy with the results or what's going on here?
No, it's just results of another deeply flawed poll.
Oh, okay. Because I thought this was a great poll. So I don't know. I'm sorry.
No, the results themselves, well, will be the judge of how flawed they are.
Okay, let's
Josh,
get to
we'll
it.
See how our listeners voted, and we will determine that. Your options in the order they played Batman, just to review here. Michael Keaton, Val Kilmer, George Clooney, Christian Bale, Ben Affleck, Robert Pattinson. Josh, how did our listeners do?
Okay, so tell me if I'm framing this correctly. They most wanted to throw out the filmography of Ben Affleck. He was in last
apparently
place. 4% of the vote. Okay. Then Val Kilmer, 6%. Then Robert Pattinson, 7%. Okay. Those three kind of at the bottom there. All their films gone. Are we going to save George Clooney's filmography? Nope. 23% of voters chose Clooney, but that still put him in third place. So all those Coen Brothers movies, they're burnt up. Michael Keaton or Christian Bale? Keaton lost 24% of the vote for Keaton. Bale got 37% of the vote. He wins this poll. His films survive. All the others go in an increasingly busy, and honestly, this is getting quite worrisome, film spotting incinerator. I mean, we're burning a lot of movies over the course of this show's history, Adam. I don't know how I feel about that.
Well, you know how we feel about stakes here on Film Spotting, and we are trying to raise them. I love how much our listeners reckoned with this deeply flawed film spotting poll. Unless you were Brett Merriman, who said, why are you doing this? This hurts. It hurts a lot. I'm going to do the only sane thing and not play your game. So I choose not to choose. Burn it all. It all goes. Everyone loses.
I didn't realize we had a preschooler among our listeners. I apologize, Brett. Here's Eleanor Dodson. How did I spend my Valentine's evening? Studying the IMDb pages of these fine gents and in-depth discussing with my partner. Then the tallying. I went with Clooney, per the math, but it was very close. I shed a tear for Real Genius and Laurel Canyon. Also noticed that Terrence Malick wades in these same Batman waters. And yes, Eleanor is right. Clooney is in Thin Red Line. Kilmer is in Song to Song. Bale is in The New World and Knight of Cups. And Affleck is in To the Wonder. I feel like Eleanor figured something out here, something connecting Batman and Terrence Malick that we've never understood before.
I'm going to say real quick, Evan, you got to up your game a little bit, maybe add some chocolate into the IMDb search here with Eleanor. And Eleanor, thank you so much for referencing Real Genius. You're right. I may have to change my vote. I can't live in a world without Real Genius. Zach Santucci says, oh no, here's another one, Josh. My wife would divorce me if I stood by while Little Women, Newsies, and Swing Kids were erased. So I think I have to vote Bale. So that's Bale in the 90s Little Women, which
yes,
I haven't seen. So I can't really compare it to Greta Gerwig's Little Women. But if it was Greta Gerwig's Little Women, then I would really be wrestling with something.
Here is Andy Mitchell, former Film Spotting production assistant. Clooney's got Soderbergh, The Coens, a Wes Anderson flick, and the South Park movie. How is he losing this? How? I'm so grateful to Andy for bringing up the South Park movie, because I saw that in Clooney's credits, and it did move the needle a little bit for me as well.
Shane from Melbourne Down Under says, I'm going with the actor who has worked consistently for over 40 years, done terrific work over the years with the likes of Burton, Tarantino, Iñárritu, Sorkin, Heckerling, Howard, Ramis, Hughes, Schlesinger, and Branagh. Steals some great scenes in Soderbergh's best film. Has been hilarious since the 80s. Voiced Pixar and Miyazaki characters. Starred in a very solid Best Picture winner. Has arguably kept his best acting for the last decade. And of course, is the best bloody Batman of the bunch. Keaton in a landslide, and I say Shane for Michael Keaton publicist, because how do you argue with that?
Yeah, I see what you did there, Shane. I like it. Here's Jim Pollini. This is cinematic torture, but a good warm-up for Film Spotting Madness. My vote for Michael Keaton has less to do with his work as Bruce Wayne Batman, but rather an endorsement of the fact that after Bill Murray in Meatballs, Stripes, and Ghostbusters, Keaton's work in Mr. Mom, Night Shift, Johnny Dangerously, and Beetlejuice provided us 80s kids with enough lunchroom quotes to last an entire high school career. We also get to keep Jackie Brown, Out of Sight, Birdman, and Spotlight in heavy rotation to fill the cinematic gap created by Sam's dark experiment. A world without mayonnaise eating tuna fish is not a world I want to live in.
Tuna fish? What if you mix mayonnaise right in the can with the tuna fish? Hold it! Hold it! Wait a minute, Chuck! Take live tuna fish and feed them mayonnaise. Oh, this is good. Call Starkist.
I think we're just going to rename this segment Sam's Dark Experiment.
I like that.
What do you say? Dylan Dom says, narrowing it down to the top two is simply a math equation. Keaton and Clooney each have twice as many movies I love as any of the others. From there, it got tougher. Do I go with the actor who gave us the best comedy supporting performance of the 2010s? That's Keaton in The Other Guys. Or the actor with multiple Coen Brothers credits? In the end, I let the better Batman movie be the deciding factor. And I went with Keaton.
All right. Makes sense. Not where I went, but I can see it. Here's Eric Nelson in Racine, Wisconsin. Not sure why I'm voting in this poll. It's not legit. If Val Kilmer loses, Top Gun never exists. Adam never falls in love with movies. And Film Spotting will never have its much anticipated episode on Maverick. That's not a world I want to live in.
I think just like in 1984, where we're always at war with Eurasia or whatever, we're going to always be anticipating Top Gun Maverick. I mean, it'll never happen.
Something's got to keep us wanting to live.
Yeah. Anthony Morris says, this was the hardest decision for me of nearly every poll you've put up. Kilmer has three of my favorite comedies in MacGruber, Top Secret, and Real Genius. Clooney has Coens. Keaton has his 2010s comeback films, Spotlight and Birdman, which I adore. Bale, solid for 20 years now. I ended up accidentally voting for Ben because Dazed and Confused changed my life when I was 10. One movie, that's
wow.
All it takes.
All right. One last comment here from Albert Malafront. Genius poll. I will be the contrarian, however, and choose Ben Affleck so I can save Gone Girl and Dazed and Confused, even though I'm also saving Geely, Jersey Girl, Pearl Harbor, and Daredevil. I love Keaton, but I've been hoping to throw Birdman in the incinerator for 8 years now. Wow. So Boyhood can take its place as the 2014 Best Picture winner, just trying to preserve Linklater over here. I don't know if that's how it works, Albert,
yeah,
but I admire your passion.
Yeah, we have really thought long and hard about how this fantasy world is constructed, and we can't retroactively change anything, unfortunately. But Albert, if that's what you need to make your pick, and especially as you clearly have such good taste, wanting Boyhood to triumph, I am with you. Thank you to everyone who voted and who left a comment. The deeply flawed film spotting poll / Sam's dark experiment will return at the conclusion of Film Spotting Madness, which, yes, is itself a month-long series of deeply flawed polls. This week, over on our sister podcast, Josh, they are finishing up their pairing of Marry Me with 1999's Notting Hill, but I'm really excited about what's next. Steven Soderbergh's new Kimmy, which we talked about last week on the show, with Tom Tykwer's Run Lola Run.
I like that. Yeah,
that's, you can see it.
Yeah, that's really, really good. And I'm sure you've already seen, Adam, that Scott Tobias, one of the Next Picture Show hosts, along with Tasha Robinson, Keith Phipps, and Genevieve Kosky, huge Kimmy fan. I mean, he's like you, he's a Soderbergher. He's all in. I mean, whatever the man does is genius. So this will be good. If you also love Soderbergh, this is an episode you should check out because Scott will have the goods on everything he really loved about Kimmy. New episodes of The Next Picture Show, looking at cinema's present via its past, they post every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. More information is at nextpictureshow.net. All right, Massacre Theater is the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a Film Spotting t-shirt. We wanted to remind you that a couple of weeks ago, Adam and I and guest Michael Phillips massacred the hell out of this scene.
It's in an envelope, a sealed envelope.
It ain't fair how he scrounged for $3 or $4, but she gets $4.
A little brat. Look at those.
It ain't fair. This here life is driving me nuts.
Make yourself useful.
When we get peanuts,
she's living fat.
Carol Burnett there with Tim Curry and Bernadette Peters in 1982's Annie, which had way more fans based on feedback than I ever thought. It was written by Thomas Meehan and Carol Sobieski, directed by John Huston. Wow, totally forgot. Yes, directed by that John Huston.
Along with that massacre, we did our top five Stephen Sondheim moments. So why that scene from Annie? Well, here's Tripp Burton. He's in Woodridge, Illinois. The answer to Massacre Theater is Annie. The connection could be that, like all of the films made of Sondheim's musicals as a full composer, it is tone-deaf, overstuffed, and a slog to get through.
Ouch.
Ouch, indeed. I think, though, I'm going to interpret that not as a jab at Sondheim, but at the adaptations of Sondheim. Fair, Josh?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's okay. Where he's going.
The connection could also be that the song in the film is sung by three Sondheim veterans, Bernadette Peters, perhaps the greatest interpreter of Sondheim's music alive, Carol Burnett, who starred in both Follies in Concert and Putting It Together, and Tim Curry, whose performance of Losing My Mind in Concert is legendary. The real connection, however, is the film Mars Attacks.
What?
Are you ready for this, Josh?
You just got my attention. I was fading there for a bit, but I'm back with you.
I know. You're back. On an episode where Josh discusses being a Tim Burton acolyte throughout the 90s and 2000s, you were obviously referencing the ending of the divisive film where the invading Martians can only be defeated by Slim Whitman's yodeling Indian Love Call, which Adam, Josh, and Michael all deftly paid homage to in their musical number. Film Spotting has brought me much comfort over the years, and now I can add that if Little Green Men ever come barging through my front door, I can take out the earbuds on episode 860. And my life will be saved.
It ain't fair how we scrounge with $3 or $4 when she gets Starbucks.
The little brat. Look in those.
That is
that good.
Fantastic. All right, here's Dave Allen from Bonnie Lake, Washington. It's Annie. I love that you pushed out of your comfort zone and tried something different. Kudos to you. But please never do it again. Some of us listen to the show while driving.
Sorry, Dave. Joy Piedmont in New York City says, Annie is kind of a terrible movie with great song and dance numbers. I watched it a lot as a kid and recently realized that what I love about it is the magic of people singing and dancing. I'm with you, Joy. Right before we taped, I was talking to Michael. I told him we were doing Annie for Massacre Theater, and he just started slagging the film, and it really was like he was destroying my childhood. And I am fully willing to admit that Annie probably is actually a bad movie, but I watched it so many times when I was 6-7 years old that I just don't want to believe it. I'm going to refuse to believe it.
And we really did get a few emails in saying they loved Annie as well, so I think there's a strong nostalgia factor with this obviously terrible movie. One last comment here from Marie Perro, right here in Chicago. It's true, I've never seen a good movie version of this show, but as a kid, I saw the original Annie on Broadway, and I remember Easy Street brought down the house.
Yeah, our Easy Street brought down the house in a Buster Keaton kind of way. Josh, reach into the pretty brimming film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
Our winner is Kelsey Hamilton in Washington, D.C.
Congratulations, Kelsey. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we will set you up with your very own film spotting t-shirt. Masker Theater now, sadly, going on its annual hiatus to make room for Film Spotting Madness. Speaking of which.
This is blasphemy. This is madness.
This is absolute madness.
This madness.
But this is absolute madness, Ambassador. Why should you build such a thing?
Madness. This is Sparta!
Talk about jolting you back into show reality, Josh. That clip. I'm sure you're a little disoriented. You're back from vacation. Who knows? Uh-huh. Maybe you're still a little hungover.
Mm.
And you have to jump right into the madness.
Well, they do have, I don't know what they actually call it, but it's like that open carry ordinance in Savannah, Georgia. Not the like absolutely insane open carry of firearms. Actually, they might have that too, but the alcohol open carry, you know, whatever you're drinking, you can just walk around town with it. We may have taken advantage, but I think I'm all right. I think I'm in a perfect mental state for Film Spotting Madness. I'll say that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably accurate. It is the 8th annual edition of Film Spotting Madness, our bracket style movie elimination tournament. This year, best of the 1970s, the tourney proper. Still a week away. You don't have to reckon with the Godfather movies or Jaws or Star Wars just yet. This week, it's just the play-in round. We had 90 films. We have to get those 90 films down to 64, which means we have 21 play-in matchups. And before we get into those polls, I will just mention that these matchups are live right now at filmspotting.net/madness. A new round opens every week on Monday afternoon, and it closes the following Monday. We do give priority to our Patreon members. They got first shot at the polls, followed by our newsletter subscribers. We mentioned that we are trying to eliminate 26 movies. We do have spread out, Josh, over 21 different matchups. And I thought the way we would do it is I would share my ranking of the top five hardest play-in matchups. And I've got the top five easiest ones, and I thought I'd go through those and just let you kind of riff, let you react in real time, tell me whether or not those matchups really are easy, hard, or maybe you don't care at all. You're indifferent, Josh, okay, to these right. Play-ins. Are you ready?
I am ready. I'm typing into my URL right now. Have not seen any of this. Filmspotting.net/madness. Here we go.
All right. You have the picks in front of you. Here are my top five easiest choices where there's really no hesitation for me. And my number one is as it should be. We traditionally have an Adam versus Josh play-in matchup. It's where we each get to pick a favorite film that did not make the cut. And it is usually the sacrificial lamb that's going to go against the overall number one seed. So it really doesn't matter which movie wins this poll other than our own personal gratification.
I'm going to go with Josh.
I'm shocked. Yeah. Didn't see that coming. I'm going with Adam.
Okay.
My easiest choice. Krzysztof Kieślowski's Camera Buff is one of my favorite films from the 1970s. And you love 1979's The Black Stallion.
Oh, man. I mean, just more valuable every year as children's family films, however you want to term them, get more antic and frantic. And sometimes that's fine. You know, case of like Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, that's part of the aesthetic. I appreciate it there. But it's not always the way you have to go. And then you look back at something like The Black Stallion, which is painterly, picturesque, patient, just gorgeous, a film for children that's as good as any movie you'll find in the 70s for adults. I love The Black Stallion.
I think it's only fitting that The Black Stallion is almost surely going to win. More people do need to see Kieślowski's Camera Buff. I needed to see it. That's why we did a Kieślowski marathon and open with that film. But I think it's only fitting that The Black Stallion is probably going to advance only to face The Godfather in round one. And we know what happens to horses in The Godfather, don't we, Josh?
Wow. Just cruel.
Yeah.
I mean, right out of the gate.
Bleak.
This is bleak and awful and a terrible experiment.
Yeah. So enjoy your victory,
wow.
Josh.
Terrible.
My number two easiest matchup. It's the Bergman play-in. Scenes from a Marriage against Cries and Whispers. I do vastly prefer Scenes from a Marriage.
I think in that case, you're right. Yeah, I would go with you there. It's a pretty easy vote for me as well, though I like both. Scenes of a Marriage is just, you know, the grander achievement.
Okay. Number three, easy play-in. The extra Altman matchup, because there's a fair amount of Altman in this bracket. It's The Long Goodbye against a movie we recently talked about in bonus content for our Patreon members, Three Women. Both,
yeah.
Again, like Bergman, both really good films. Clear winner for me, though, in Elliot Gould as Philip Marlowe, Long Goodbye, a movie I love.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I remember right, I probably star rating-wise put them on the same plane, but Three Women is definitely much more of a curiosity that I appreciated, and Long Goodbye is something that was more of a piece altogether that I really got on the same vibe with.
Yeah. So this one, I'm not sure you'll be able to vote in because I can't remember if you finally did rectify this blind spot or if you're still resisting because you know it might end our relationship. We have a Jazz Hands...
Oh boy.
Slash Bob Fosse play in.
No.
The film that earned him Best Director of 1972. No, it didn't go to Coppola. Cabaret against All That Jazz. My beloved All That Jazz. And even though I am a big fan of Cabaret, All That Jazz is one of the movies I list on my favorite four over on Letterboxd. So yeah, it's winning for me.
Yeah, I value our relationship, Adam, so I'm not going to risk it by seeing Cabaret.
Okay. I appreciate that. Finally, there's a Monty Python play-in that I think is easy. It's not how listeners are going to vote. The Life of Brian going up against The Holy Grail. And I laugh a lot more at The Life of Brian than I do The Holy Grail.
Boy, it's been so long since I've seen, honestly, Life of Brian is one of those, have I ever sat down and seen the whole thing? Or have I just seen the best comedic bits? I would say it's the reverse for me. Holy Grail, I remember much more distinctly and laugh, have many more funny memories of that one. So I'm going to have to go with the Holy Grail here.
Stop! Who would cross the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side, he see.
Ask me the questions, Bridgekeeper. I'm not afraid.
What is your name?
My name is Sir Lancelot of Camelot.
What is your quest?
To seek the Holy Grail.
What is your favorite color?
Blue.
Right, off you go.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, here were my top five toughest. The ones, even as I'm about to read them, I don't know which way I'm going to vote. My number one toughest. We've got a Wandering Jack play-in. So Jack Nicholson, roaming, searching for meaning, Josh, in all of these films. Five Easy Pieces, a movie that probably just should be in the tournament, not a play-in. But guess what? You can say that about Hal Ashby's The Last Detail. And you can also say that about Antonioni's The Passenger. I can't believe it, but I actually think The Passenger is my favorite of those three films, but the other two are fantastic as well.
Savor this moment, Adam. Savor this. You are going to look so knowledgeable, so esteemed as a film critic.
0-3?
Haven't seen any of those.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that just means you've got some great watching ahead of you.
Yeah, I'd love to get to it at some point, but unfortunately, okay. I didn't get to it in time for this vote.
What about Peter Bogdanovich? Speaking of movies that should just be in the tournament, The Last Picture Show, we did pair it with Paper Moon, a great Bogdanovich film that there was a lot of clamor for. And I thought, okay, let's see how it comes out. Let's see if listeners feel so strongly about it that it actually might even edge out The Last Picture Show and make the bracket of 64. Have you seen both, and do you have a clear favorite?
Only seen Last Picture Show, and after Bogdanovich's passing, Paper Moon is the one. I'm going to mostly disappoint my dad here. He texted me and said that is the one that you've absolutely got to watch, and I still need to do it. So I can't vote in this matchup, unfortunately.
I think I like Paper Moon more. I do. And they're both great. We mentioned Hal Ashby. My number three toughest is a Hal Ashby trifecta. Being There versus Harold and Maude versus Shampoo. And I really like all three of these films, and I feel similarly about all three films. They're very different movies, but I put them all at about the exact same level, Josh. I'm inclined to go with Harold and Maude just because it's that cult classic that kind of feels like it really needs to stay around and we can't throw it into the film spotting incinerator. But if I was actually picking which one of the three is my favorite movie, it might be Peter Sellers and Being There.
Okay. Have seen all three, like all three. I have a clear vote here, and it's thanks to a recent case of blind spotting. And I don't think this is recency bias either, because Being There and Harold and Maude, I first saw for the first time in the last, I'd say, maybe 5 years. So I have a fairly good grasp of all three of these, but for me, it's Shampoo. It's Shampoo all the way.
I had a feeling.
That was kind of a revelation how much I did enjoy that picture. So that's where I would go.
All right. My number four toughest matchup. I'm calling the Mothers of Sorrow play-in. You've got Carrie, Brian De Palma's Carrie, against Dario Argento's Suspiria. And it is tough for me because when we first put these films together, we being myself and our producer Sam, I thought, well, of course it's Carrie. Sissy Spacek and Piper Laurie, and she's so terrifying as Carrie's mom. And yet, there's something about the curiosity that is Suspiria that has me giving it the slight edge. I don't want to live in a world where I can't throw in something as wacky as Suspiria.
Yeah, that's valid. Suspiria, you know, I like both of these. It's not an easy choice. I feel like Suspiria does a couple of things really, really well. And Carrie maybe doesn't do anything quite as well as, let's say, the use of color as Suspiria does, but does manage to pull off a lot more within, you know, its running time. So close for me, but I think I would go for Carrie in this one.
Okay, so we'll do this very quickly here. You're just going to give me no commentary, your gut reaction pick. So either name the movie you prefer, or you can say you abstain because you haven't seen at least one of the films. Four others that I thought were fairly easy. Fights to the Death, Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon, or The Warriors from Walter Hill.
Have only seen Enter the Dragon, which I like, so I can't vote here.
Underdogs, three sports film from the 70s, Bad News Bears versus Breaking Away versus Slapshot.
You know, Slapshot, I think I saw scenes from at a friend's house a couple of times when I was a kid, so can't vote in this one.
Okay. I think you can vote in this one, and I think I know how you're going to vote. We have Wandering Jack and we have Dancing John, as in John Travolta. You can go Grease or Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, man, this is harder than you would think. I mean, I'm not a Saturday Night Fever. I know this is supposed to be brief. I'm sorry. This is the madness. I'm not a Saturday Night Fever hater. I just have major issues with it. I think I would also have issues with Grease, but oh gosh, why is this so hard for me? What? I love the musical numbers in Grease, but Travolta's dancing is better in Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah.
But Saturday Night Fever's filming of the dancing is not as good as I think what we get in Grease. I'm going Grease. Call me the Saturday Night Fever hater. I'm going to embrace it. It's Grease.
Well, I do need to point out that I misspoke, and these aren't four others that I thought were easy. These are four others I thought were really hard, actually. I just watched Enter the Dragon, one of my four blind spots in the entire tournament. So out of all the 90 films, four I hadn't seen. And as much as I love The Warriors, you're watching Bruce Lee and thinking, how can I not keep that movie alive and be able to go back to this and watch the way that movie is filmed in terms of capturing Lee's movements? Maybe nostalgia gives Warriors the slight advantage to me. Probably go Bad News Bears of the Underdogs. And I'm with you, even though I am a Saturday Night Fever appreciator, nostalgia is going to win out, and I'm voting Grease. My final one here, Josh, that I thought was pretty difficult, and I know it will be for you too, even though I think we both already made this choice. We did already make this choice. We had to pick a best picture from our Elaine May marathon. Do you go A New Leaf or do you go The Heartbreak Kid?
Yeah, that is a really tough one. My gut instinct, and I'd have to look it up. I think I rated them both the same. My gut instinct is New Leaf. I think just the freshness of the vision there. I'll put it this way. I think about A New Leaf more than I think about The Heartbreak Kid, even though I really like both. So I'm going to go New Leaf.
I'm the same, and that's why I voted A New Leaf as well. Okay, seven more quick here. Easier ones for me. We'll see where you stand. An Out of the Past matchup. Grey Gardens, the Maisels documentary, versus George Lucas's American Graffiti.
Let's just say, this could be wrong, but let's just say American Graffiti. I appreciate Grey Gardens as kind of a monumental instance of documentary cinema, but also have some documentary ethical questions related to that one. So for that reason, I'm going to go with American Graffiti.
Okay. The Maisels with two shots at making the big dance and probably going to go 0-2. Their Gimme Shelter is one of the concert docs we have going against Martin Scorsese's The Last Waltz.
I have not seen either of those.
Wow. Okay. How about The Gunfighters? I'm pretty sure you haven't seen at least one of these. Sam Peckinpah's Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid against Clint Eastwood, the outlaw, Josie Wales.
Yeah, I'm 0-2 in this category as well.
What about debuts? David Lynch with Eraserhead or Lucas with THX 1138?
Oh, man. I mean, THX is a really good film, but
it's not Eraserhead.
You are in a whole different category when it comes to Eraserhead.
Yeah, for the record, this is another one of those films that Sam and I were very aware Eraserhead just needed to be in the tournament, and we were also pretty sure it would win, so no harm done. How about this one? I know how you would vote, though maybe you haven't seen all three films. They'll Kill Us If They Ever Got the Chance. Conspiracy paranoia thrillers from the 70s. 3 Days of the Condor, The Parallax View, or Coppola's The Conversation.
Yeah, I can't vote, even though I tried to do my homework and did see The Conversation recently, but have not seen The Parallax View. So between Conversation and 3 Days, it's clearly Conversation.
Okay. The last two here, international features, Buñuel's subversive satires, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie versus That Obscure Object of Desire.
A tough one. I'm going to give it, and man, I can't recall if this is where I went when we did our Buñuel Marathon Awards, but based on memory and thinking about it as the time has gone by, I'm going to give it to Discreet Charm.
Yeah, that's where I'm going as well. Finally, this is one I can't vote in yet, one of my blind spots, Tarkovsky. Stalker versus Solaris.
Really difficult. Really, really difficult.
Yeah.
For me, thinking about them both now, Solaris seems more of the complete piece, where Stalker is still in my memory somewhat of a puzzle with sequences that absolutely haunt me. And because Tarkovsky is a filmmaker I will never figure out, I'm fairly confident, I'm going to go with the one that still haunts me. I think that's representative of his work. So I'm going to go with Stalker.
Okay. I thought you were talking yourself into Solaris there, and you zagged when I thought you were zigging.
Stalker it is.
Which is fine. Solaris is a film I think is brilliant. So Stalker really will have to do something on me in order to overtake it and get my vote. Those are the play-in matchups for Film Spotting Madness Round 1, coming officially next week as we get to these results, and we'll go through some of our favorite matchups of Round 1. You can go to filmspotting.net/madness, see the complete tournament shortlist, and we'll remind you that one of the best parts of this, and I'm already forgetting, Josh, whether it's only been 1 year or it's been multiple years, but we did figure out how to turn this into what it should be, an actual bracket prediction contest.
Yes.
Where listeners get to go and make their choices, and the winner gets some great prizes. So look forward to that. Round 1 coming and the prediction contest coming soon. That's our show.
If you want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Letterboxd, you can do that at Film Spotting. I'm also at Larson on Film. In the show archives at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005. You can also vote in the play-in round of Film Spotting Madness, Best of the 1970s. 64 films enter, only one remains. To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop. And you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
out in wide release this weekend, Cyrano, the musical adaptation from director Joe Wright, starring Peter Dinklage, songs by Aaron and Bryce Dessner of The National. Studio 666 is also out. That's the Foo Fighters moving into a mansion steeped in grisly rock and roll history to record an album. Next week, here on the show, the second film in our Buster Keaton marathon, Our Hospitality, and we will talk about The Batman.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Betty Lavendero. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.